This is the Haru Bhaktiti Mahotsav of Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, 2007, September 5th, which is also called Nandotsav, big festival of Nanda Maharaj celebrating the joyous birth of his beautiful and sweet son, Nandalal Kishoranandan. So this year I wanted to read something from a very wonderful book that's recently been published by the longest standing personal secretary of Srila Prabhupada, Shruti Kirti. He wrote a book about his remembrances of Prabhupada, which he collected together into 175 different anecdotes, and the title of the book is called What is the Difficulty? I remember when I joined in Los Angeles in 75, all the devotees very often use this phrase. When the temple commander would request you to do some service that you thought maybe was hard or difficult to perform, or any type of challenge in devotional service, and you resisted or gave some opposition, then he would say, what is the difficulty? It's easy to do, just surrender to Krishna. So Prabhupada many times he would ask his disciples, what is the difficulty? In lectures you hear Prabhupada giving lectures, he's talking about Krishna consciousness is kevala ananda kanda, it is simply joyfully performed. And he says, what is the difficulty? Is it difficult to chant Hare Krishna? Is it difficult to take prasad? Is it difficult to study the wonderful philosophy of Bhagavat? Is it difficult to dance before the deities or dance in Rath Yatra? Is it difficult to live in a beautiful temple? Is it difficult to bathe and wear clean clothes? Is it difficult to meditate on Krishna's Vrindavan pastimes? Is it difficult to serve a pure devotee of the Lord? Is it difficult to preach the glories of Krishna and Gauranga and Bhakti? What is the difficulty? The Prabhupada would often ask his devotees, what is the difficulty? So whenever Prabhupada would ask that question, his disciples could not really answer, because Prabhupada mercifully removed all the difficulty out of this process of Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada would often say, what is the difficulty? This process, this Krishna consciousness, this process is so simple. Just chant Hare Krishna and be happy. If you chant 16 rounds and follow the four regulative principles, then at the end of this life you'll go back home, back to Godhead. So all glories to Srila Prabhupada. What is the difficulty, as he would say. So in 1972, there was one anecdote, number 15. I have given you Sandesh, Rasgula, and Sweet Balls. So Shruti Kirti was explaining to Prabhupada how in New Vrindavan, they were offering arti to the cows. And Prabhupada had a frown on his face. And then Shruti Kirti asked Prabhupada if it was okay to offer arti, and Prabhupada said no. And then the disciple asked, what can we do special for the cows? Prabhupada said, keep them clean, brush them nicely, bathe them, and you can also polish their horns and hooves. The Prabhupada was very practical. Devotees, possibly they were offering arti, considering the cow to be worshipable as the Brahmins, Namo Brahmani Devaya, Go Brahman Hitaya, Chajagat Hitaya, Krishnaya, Govindaya, Namo Namah. We offer arti to the Mahajans and the Guru, and to Krishna, so why not the cow? But Prabhupada could understand that offering arti is simple and sentimental, but the practical service of keeping them clean and brushing them every day and bathing them, that's difficult, that's hard. And polishing their horns and hooves not only makes them look good, but keeps them healthy and prevents their horns and hooves from getting cracked by rubbing ghee on them or some type of proper oil. So Prabhupada was always emphasizing practicality. He said, Krishna consciousness is common sense. first become conscious, then become Krishna conscious. So don't act crazy. Use common sense and do the needful. So then he talks about how Shruti Kirti made cheese and turned it into sandesh this morning, and he offers it to Prabhupada for lunch. And Prabhupada asked if he made them, and he said he did. And then Prabhupada liked them, because sandesh was one of Prabhupada's favorite sweets. So on days like this, on Guru Purnima or Prabhupada's appearance day or any time, we can prepare a nice sandesh the way Prabhupada taught us and offer it to Thakurji, to Radha Vrindavan Chandra, Radha Gopinath, Radha Rasvi Hari, Radha Giridhari, then give Prabhupada the remnants. So then number 17, Prabhupada was in L.A. in his garden. This is in 1972. This is in New Dwarka. Despite Los Angeles was such a smog-filled, polluted city, his garden in the back of the parking lot seemed like part of the spiritual world. It was simply a parking lot for the old church that they took over and made into a temple. At the back part, someone brought in some dirt and dug up the asphalt and built a little wooden wall around it and put Tulsi there and many flowers and made a wonderful asan for Prabhupada. He would sit there in the afternoon and often meet with professors and disciples and leaders of ISKCON. And he liked it very much. So Prabhupada said he liked this garden more than there was 30 Tulsi plants flourishing. And Prabhupada said that this garden in Los Angeles in New Dwarka was his favorite place, despite having traveled the world. At that time, Prabhupada said, wherever there is Tulsi, it is Vrindavan. Of course, wherever Prabhupada traveled, it was Vrindavan, because he was always in the service of Radha and Krishna, and always engaging others in the service of Radha and Krishna, and speaking and glorifying Radha and Krishna, because Krishna and Vrindavan were always residing in his heart. He didn't require anything else. Prabhupada lived a very simple life. Once he was in New York, in his apartment, and he told his disciples, he said, don't think I'm sitting in a New York apartment. I'm actually sitting in Vrindavan. Moramani Habe Sri Vrindavan Dham. So this was told in Chaitanya Charitamrita that Dvaitacharya said, Mahaprabhu, Lord Chaitanya, wherever you are, that is Vrindavan, because you're always thinking of Vrindavan. Now he's meditating on Krishna's eternal service in Vrindavan. But nevertheless, Prabhupada, he liked that garden in Los Angeles, and we had seen that garden, and we did some service there when we joined. And when Prabhupada came there in 74 and 75, he also sat in the garden speaking to different professors from local universities. And although we didn't have the adhikar to sit at Prabhupada's feet in his private garden, many of the Sankirtan devotees and other brahmacharis, we would gather together in the back prasadam room. There was a front prasadam room, the main one, and a back prasadam room on the first floor of the residential area where all the brahmacharis lived in the L.A. temple in New Dwarka. So we'd gather in the back prasadam room, and we would squat down on the floor, hiding near the window along the wall facing the garden. And then we'd peek out the window from the bottom and open the windows and try to hear Prabhupada's lotus voice and catch a few words of his preaching or a few words of his chastisement to the scientists or his challenges. And we consider our life perfect if we could just get a glance of Prabhupada's golden face or hear a few of his lotus-like words sprinkled with the pollen nectar from the lotus feet of Krishna coming directly from the spiritual world. And we tried not to disturb Prabhupada in his favorite garden, but we were so compelled and so attracted that we couldn't come out from there and couldn't take our eyes off Prabhupada. So sometimes we'd be watching Prabhupada with 20 or 30 other brahmacharis and listening, and then Prabhupada would laugh and we would hear something he would say also from there. It was really only about 15 feet away from Prabhupada, but it was on the first floor and he was on the ground floor, ground level. And we would also laugh, and then Prabhupada would glance up at the windows and we would duck down and try to hide. Then he would say, he told Tulsi Das, the temple president, he said, oh, they're disturbing. What are they doing there? So then Tulsi Das came up to the prasadam room and he said, hey, get away from here. You brahmacharis are disturbing Prabhupada. And then we would all be very quiet and leave. And then as soon as Tulsidas left, then we would come back and try to be extra special, careful and quiet, so we continue to look at our spiritual master, our eternal savior, and our eternal well-wisher. Now this is anecdote 18. The sky is the color of Krishna. This is also in Prabhupada's garden in Los Angeles. Prabhupada looked at the sky and he said, "The sky is the color of Krishna." Or he asked, he said, "Is the sky the color of Krishna?" Then a disciple answered, "In Krishna book it says that Krishna is dark blue like a thundercloud." Then Prabhupada said, "The sky is the color of Krishna. The sky is the light from Krishna's bodily effulgence that makes the sky blue." Then 19, Prabhupada was, he was explaining about how to become refreshed after traveling. And this is also told in Ayurveda. He said, because there was a disciple washing his feet, and Prabhupada instructed him, "Please wash up to my knees. Pour water from my knees down to my feet. This kind of foot bath refreshes one's whole body after traveling." This is actually a fact. I had read that in Ayurveda, and after going on Govardhan Parikrama, or going around town doing some seva for Thakurji, or going to some preaching program or whatever, I would go in the bathroom and just lift up my dhoti and wash my legs from my knees to my feet. Not just feet, but knees all the way to feet, and I would feel very refreshed. So these are the words of Prabhupada, and of course the Shastra also, and Prabhupada lived according to the Shastra. So he's teaching his disciples all the practical knowledge, not only philosophy, but he's teaching us how to live simply and healthily and think highly, simple living and high thinking. Always think of Radha and Krishna and Vrindavan and their praying save and the groves of Vrindavan and the preaching service of Lord Gauranga on this plain of Boma Vrindavan or Boma Navadvip. So Prabhupada was always giving helpful advice to his disciples, and those that were smart and sincere would record it in their hearts and also apply it and reap the results of Prabhupada's very practical knowledge and very wholesome advice to help all of his disciples keep healthy, healthy, wealthy, and wise, as they say. So once, in a very hot day, Prabhupada was in Vrindavan, and again he reminded everyone, after returning to his quarters from an engagement in the hot outside of Vrindavan, Prabhupada immediately went into the bathroom and washed his feet and his legs with cold water. After coming out of his bathroom, again he repeated that the whole body becomes rejuvenated. So in this way, Prabhupada was teaching us the ancient standard of Vedic etiquette and its practical application. Prabhupada was the most pure practical philosopher. Of course, Prabhupada had a special way of saying different words. And I remember myself, when I was living in Potomac, Washington, in the temple there with Nagaraj Das, 1980, 1981, we had compiled a list as we would listen to Prabhupada's various tapes, lecture tapes, room conversations, morning walks. We compiled a list of the special way Prabhupada would pronounce words. So once Prabhupada was asked his disciple Shruti Kirti to make some chips. Of course, this is the British English phrase or word for French fries. In America, they say French fries, but in Britain and India, who followed the British standard of English, the term chips means small slices of potato fried in oil or ghee, sprinkled with salt and pepper and ketchup or some kind of tomato chutney. But in America they're called French fries. So The Prabhupada was raised in India with the British standard of English, especially in the 1890s and 1900s. So once he asked his servant, Shrutikirti, to make me some chips. But when he described how to make them, he said, make them thin and crispy. Make the chips or the french fries thin and crispy. So Prabhupada often used such endearing expressions. The actual expression is thin and crispy. He wanted them to be thin and somewhat crunchy, or like potato chips, crackly. But he preferred to use the word crispy instead of crispy. And then Shrutikirti started using the word crispy because it sounded crunchier. So I remember Prabhupada used words like, we have to purify ourselves. And I have just been traveling from Australia to Tokyo. Now I've gone to the Philippines, the Philippine Islands, Manila. In 1972, Prabhupada went to Manila in the Philippines. But we generally say Philippines. Prabhupada said Philippines. And he would often say in his preaching that God, or the Absolute Truth, is infinitesimal, and the tathasta jiva, the jivatma, he is a tiny part and parcel of God. Mai vamsho jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana. Eternal Krishna is the eternal fragmental part, as he says in Bhagavad Gita. Krishna tells Arjuna. When Prabhupada was using these two terms, he would say God, the Absolute Truth, Krishna is infinite, and the jiva is infinitesimal. So that was Prabhupada's very endearing way of saying infinitesimal. God is infinite and the jiva is infinitesimal. Generally you say infinitesimal, but... And like this are many, many phrases which I can't remember now. But they're very sweet and they are special Prabhupada phrases. And because we love Prabhupada and we loved everything about him, or we do love everything about him, the way he speaks, the way he walks, the way he sits, and... the way he sings, the way he speaks, the way he does everything is attractive to us and endearing to us, and we like to emulate it and remember it and relish it forever. So this is reminiscences number 25, where Prabhupada is teaching about serve others and cook for others. So one day, of course, usually the Shrutikirti was cooking Krishna's lunch, but this was in Vrindavan. And this is called Now Tomorrow You Must Serve Her. This is Radhadamodar Temple in Vrindavan, 1972, Kartik, October. Yamuna Devi was also there. So one particular day, Prabhupada asked Yamuna to cook his lunch. And then afterwards, of course, Shrutikirti took the Mahamahaprasadam, and after tasting Yamuna Devi's cooking, Shruti realized they had never even before tasted prasadam. He was wondering how Prabhupada was somehow managing to eat what he was offering to him on a daily basis. And so he understood that Krishna must have sent Yamuna Devi to Vrindavan to sumptuously feed Srila Prabhupada, because every preparation that Yamuna had made for Prabhupada's pleasure was incredibly tasty. The chapatis were perfect. The sabjis tasted as if they came from the spiritual world. So at that time, Shrutikirti realized what a disservice he was actually doing by cooking for Prabhupada. Now he understood that the Jamuna's cooking was actually transcendental. So after Shruti finished honoring Prabhupada's remnants, and Prabhupada asked him, how did you like the meal? And then Shruti said, yes, it was very good. And Prabhupada smiled and he said, all right, today Yamuna Devi has fixed your lunch. Now tomorrow you can cook for her. This is the Vedic custom. Today she has done some service for you. Now tomorrow you must serve her. And Prabhupada went on to say, at other times he'd also say, one always has to be ready to serve a person. Not simply you are always accepting service. You call someone or you address some other brahmachari or this godbrother, you say, oh, Prabhu, but Prabhu means master, that the other person is your master and you are his servant. So what is the question of you accepting service from your master? You are a servant and you are calling them Prabhu and then accepting so much service from your master. Therefore, I am calling you Prabhu. It means I must render service. This attitude must be there. I am everyone's servant because I am calling everyone Prabhu. So this is a nice instruction Prabhupada was giving at this time. Is that he was asking, he said, today she cooked for you, tomorrow you cook for her. I often have done the same thing here at the ashram in Radhakund. Some devotees come and I say, all right, today you're here for a couple of days. Today I'll cook prasadam for Thakurji. I'll make the khichdi and steam sabji or rice or whatever. For Giriraj, and tomorrow you and your wife can cook or whatever. And then the disciples say, no, we'll cook for you. You're our guru, you're a sannyasi. Why should we take service from you? We should serve you. We came here to serve you. But this is not the heart of a Vaishnava. The heart of a Vaishnava is das, 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 anar das. Trinadapi sunichenama. Sunichena. Lower than a straw in the street, seeing everyone as his master and wanting to serve everyone. So Prabhupada is showing this teaching that, yes, this is the attitude one must have. An attitude of always ready to render service and seeing others as Prabhu. Not looking for an opportunity to exploit someone or receive service, but always looking for an opportunity to help someone else and render service, make someone else happy, make the other devotees happy, please them, serve them. Don't try to engage others in your service, but try to engage yourself in their service. This is devotional mentality. This is the heart of the Vaishnava. So Prabhupada gave this nice teaching. Then again in Vrindavan, in 1972 at Radhadhar Temple, Radhadamodar Temple. So this is a practical thing just for Brahmins. Shruti Kirti was saying how Prabhupada would change his Brahmin thread, either on Purnima, the full moon day, or on Ekadasi. And that was every month. Shruti Kirti, his service was to place a new Brahmin thread on Prabhupada's desk at Radhadharmadhar Temple every month. So one time a month, Prabhupada would change his thread and chant on a new thread while holding his old one. This is the system. It's told in the Shastras that one should change the thread whenever it becomes contaminated or becomes broken, or once a month on full moon or Ekadasi. So Prabhupada was following the ideal instructions of Hari Bhakti Vilas and always having a very clean and new Brahmin thread. And the system is that you put the new one on and then you chant, you wrap the old and new one together around your thumb and cover your right hand with a cloth. Then you chant at least the first, the Brahma Gayatri Om Bhurbhuvah Svah on both threads together 10 times. Or you may chant Gopal Mantra or Kam Gayatri. And then after finishing the chanting of 10 times, Brahma Gayatri on the old and new threads together, then you step out of the old thread, you pull it down your body, be careful not to step on it, pull it down from your shoulder, down your waist, down your legs, and then you cut it and burn it. Or sometimes Prabhupada said you can bury it under Tulsi, but that makes Tulsi pretty crowded if you're in a city temple. You can burn it or you can throw it in a sacred river or bury it in some ground somewhere. This is a sacred item. It's upavita, yagya upavita. It's actually considered to be an expansion. At least in Krishna's case, a Brahmin thread around the body of Dwarkadish or Narayan is actually Natashesh, an expanded form of Lord Balaram. So what Shruti Kirti noticed, that after Prabhupada had removed his old thread, the discarded thread, he had pulled apart each of the threads. So that means that Prabhupada had snapped the threads or cut them. Yes, at this time Prabhupada told Shruti Kirti, you can bury the Brahmin thread underneath a tulsi plant in the temple courtyard. Put it in the dirt under the roots. So that's what, at least what Prabhupada said to do, how to discard an old Brahmin thread. So in 1972, in anecdote 29, Prabhupada talks about how to attain Bhag Siddhi, or perfection in speech, which oftentimes other Vaishnavas and other sampradayas, or these pracharaks, or these professional Bhagavat reciters, they do various purushcharan vratas, very elaborate austerities and pujas and feeding of Brahmins on a daily basis and chanting so many Gopal mantras, so many lakhs of times in a dark room without seeing the sun for 30 or 40 days in order to get sakshat darshan of Saraswati or Hanuman or some other ishta, and then beg for some boon or benediction. They often ask for Vag Siddhi, the perfection of speech, so that all the shastras and the conclusion of the shastras will reside in their tongue, and they'll have total recall and remembrance of all the teachings of the Bhagavatam and become very expert in speaking Bhagavatam, so they can earn a lot of money as professional speakers. So it's called Purushcharan Brat. But sometimes people also observe Purushcharan Brat for the sincere purpose of realizing Radha and Krishna or attaining their divine service. It's told in the histories and biographies and charitras that Das Goswami performed Purushcharan Brat and Sanatan and Rupa and Bhakti Vinod and Gorakishore. It's very common amongst the Gaudiya Vaishnavas, the Siddha saints would often perform any number of Purushcharan Bratas with a sincere desire to serve Krishna more perfectly with a more purified body. But nowadays it's a little difficult because of the circumstances and times and the Manda Samanda Matayo bodies that we have, the weak fallen bodies that we have, it's very difficult to engage in Purushcharan Brata. But Prabhupada was explaining a very wonderful truth, and he said at that time, October 19th, 1972, that everything he speaks will be perfect. By chanting 16 rounds of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra every day, following the four regulative principles, rising early in the morning during Brahma Muhurta, and reducing one's eating and sleeping, one gets spiritual energy. If one follows these guidelines for 12 years, everything he says will be perfect. Perfect means siddhi or perfection, and speaking means vag. So Prabhupada was giving a very simple way to perform Purushcharan Brata, or attain Vag Siddhi by following his standard program of Krishna consciousness. Of course, this number of 12 years is very interesting throughout different Jyotish Vidya Shastras. This phrase is often considered that 12 years of a human being's life is like a mini yuga. Of course, a yuga is a vast period of time. It can be lakhs and lakhs of years, like Kali Yuga is also a yuga. And it's 4,32,000 years, 432,000 years in duration. And of course, humans don't live that long, but a yuga in a human life, a yuga is like 12 years. So this is the remembrance number 44. Excuse me, 45. The Khitri has created havoc. So one of Prabhupada's transcendental characteristics was he never wasted anything. And he manifested this quality in many of his pastimes. Now, this is an important principle of Krishna consciousness, that the devotee realizes, he understands and he realizes that everything belongs to Krishna. It's not just a shlok in a book, Ishavasyam idam sarvam. It says in Ishopanishad that everything is owned and controlled by the Lord, and one should set aside those things that are set that are offered as his quota, accept those things and not take more, knowing that everything belongs to Krishna. This is the point, that we shouldn't waste Krishna's energy. We learn and we study, we try to realize that everything is Krishna's energy, everything belongs to Krishna, and we should only use the minimal for our own, what we need. Do the needful, use the needful. For example, when someone is brushing their teeth in the morning, which is something everyone does, they go in the bathroom, turn the water on full speed, and put a little toothpaste on their brush and start brushing their teeth and singing some songs and looking at their face and brushing for 5-10 minutes, whatever. And meanwhile, the water is just running for no reason at all, just the water is keeping going. The sound of the water is like background music to your brushing your teeth and singing, or brushing your teeth and admiring your beautiful face. You're just wasting gallons and gallons and liters of this precious substance called water, which is one of Krishna's 8 material energies, Ashta Prakriti. It belongs to Krishna. It's God-given, God-made. It's not made by scientists or made by us. It's made by God. It's arranged with the demigods, the ocean, the rivers, the mountains, the wind and the air, and the sun god and the wind god and the water god. So we should just turn on the water, put a few milliliters of water in your brush and some toothpaste, turn off the water and brush your teeth. Then turn on the water, empty your mouth, wash your mouth, wash your face, finished. All face washing and teeth brushing done with a half a liter of water. And bathing also, or leaving lights on, going in one room for a second to pick up a book or get some piece of clothing, and then leaving the light on there and not turning it off. Wasting electric energy, wasting water energy. Or cooking, we're cooking, and we cook too much food, and we throw out so much food because we can't properly estimate how much rice is required for the guest, or how much flour for the rotis. So we waste too much flour, and we throw out the food. It's very sinful. It's actually considered sinful to throw away food grains. For every food grain that someone throws away, that many less food grains he'll have to eat in his next life. That's why they have the phrase that that person's name is written on every food grain before he takes birth. So whatever food grains he's going to receive in his next life will be determined in this life. So if we waste thousands and millions of food grains, in the next life we will be starving. So then this is in entry 47 about Srila Prabhupada's taking prasadam. Occasionally, not very often, occasionally Prabhupada let some of his leading disciples sit in his room while he took prasadam. Usually it was during breakfast time. And he was speaking to two of his leaders from New Zealand, 1973. But it was a benediction because it was not something that Prabhupada did very often. Usually Prabhupada would honor his prasadam alone in his room and also in silence, because this is one of the principles of Vaishnavas, that they should eat in silence. You can also see in Hari Bhakti Vilas and Padma Pran Skanda Pran, when it talks about Kartik Vrat or Chaturmasya Vrat, one of the Vratas that's actually very pleasing to the Lord is to eat every day, once a day, in silence. Just by eating every day in silence, you can attain Vaikuntha. It's one of the benedictions. So then there was some discussion in this temple, and this is New Zealand in Auckland in 73, and this number 47 entry, Krishna likes sugar very much. So many times devotees get into health kicks or health fads where they're very concerned about sugar, and it's very bad, destroys all the B vitamins in the body, and it's unhealthy. They try to start imposing the health standard on Krishna's prasadam, Krishna's bhoga. So they start cooking for Krishna with honey or jaggery. At least in this Archan Marg, where we have these big temples of deities installed by Prabhupada, this particular occasion, Shruti Kirti went in the deity kitchen to find some sugar for Prabhupada's hot milk in the evening. He couldn't find any sugar in the kitchen, so he flavored Prabhupada's milk with honey. So when Prabhupada tasted the hot milk, he said, "Why is the milk not sweetened with sugar?" And then he said, his servant said, "They don't have any sugar in the temple." And Prabhupada became angry. He said, "How can that be?" Then the servant said, "Well, here the devotees think that white sugar is not healthy. It's better to avoid it." And Prabhupada said, "Okay, that's fine. If they don't want to eat sugar, they don't have to. But Krishna likes sugar very much. This is nonsense. They must use sugar when they make preparations for the deities. So this, apparently there can be, Prabhupada's allowing there to be dual standard here. Of course, devotees are only supposed to eat prasadam, not something separate or different or special from Krishna. Whatever Krishna eats, we should eat, honor, appreciate, and love. If he likes rotis and sabji and puris and these things, then we should eat his mahaprasad. Not that we substitute what we like for what he likes. But Prabhupada did give some leeway. He said if they don't want to eat sugar, they don't have to. They can eat something else. That means they're eating something that's not offered to Krishna. But that's another point. But Prabhupada said they must use sugar when they make preparations for the deities. So Shruti Kirti is remembering that Prabhupada was, he's saying, Prabhupada, you were astonishing. Wherever you went, you quickly cut through all of the creative nonsense invented by your disciples. So this idea of cooking for the deities with honey and throwing out all the sugar was not very much appreciated by Srila Prabhupada. So we have to consider what Krishna likes and balance it with what we can also eat. Because of course family deities or personal deities, there may be a different standard there due to the demands of the worshipper, the health demands or the health needs. At least in temple deities, deities established by Prabhupada, they should be offered sweet rice and other preparations with sugar. And now he talks about, this is passage 57, and he says that sometimes the simplest service for the spiritual master, disciple may be given some very relatively easy or simple service to perform, but it may become the most demanding or most impossible to complete. And everyone has had that experience. I'm sure the listeners of this tape have also had the experience of being given very simple service by the spiritual master, then because of ignorance or procrastination they put it off till the last moment, and then they can't execute it because the time doesn't allow or the circumstance becomes unfavorable or they meet too much opposition. Then they become a failure in rendering even the most simple service. So Shruti Kirti is saying the simplest arrangements are often the biggest cause of anxiety, especially in India. So this service was to heat up a bucket of water for Prabhupada's bath. Apparently it was cold, it was very cold in Mayapur at the time. And of course Prabhupada generally wanted to bathe in warm water due to his old age. It was better to for maintaining his health. So he put the immersion heater in the brass bucket to warm it for Prabhupada's bath. But the immersion heater didn't always work because there were power cutoffs, or the heaters were burned out, or the electricity went off. And Prabhupada would often be ready for his bath, but there was no warm water. So Prabhupada shouted, "Why do you not have any hot water for bath?" Of course, this was Mayapur, where they had some electricity. But in Vrindavan in 72 and 73, maybe, when Vrindavan said, he said, Prabhupada gave a practical suggestion. He said, "There's no electricity. You can put the bucket of water outside on the roof, and the sun will heat it sufficiently for taking a bath." So Shruti replies that, yes, that usually worked, except when the monkeys decided they wanted to drink from the bucket and knocked it over in the process and spilled all the water on the roof. So anyone lived in Vrindavan knows how mischievous the monkeys are and how they can foil any attempt someone makes to do service or cook something or hang out their clothes or anything. They're very pesky creatures to deal with in Vrindavan. So remembering this whole episode of water for bath, Shruti Kirti comments, and we can consider this for all of us because we're all servants of Guru and we're all servants of Krishna. This is an important instruction. He's saying that serving Srila Prabhupada, or you can substitute Srila Prabhupada for serving Radha Swami or Gopal Krishna Goswami or serving any Guru. Serving Guru or Srila Prabhupada was very easy if you were Krishna conscious, Guru conscious, Prabhupada conscious. To serve Guru expertly, all the disciple needed was to think of the Guru 24 hours a day instead of thinking of himself. It doesn't require a big education. So to serve the Guru, you don't need a PhD in computer science or a language degree or MBBS or to be a doctor. You don't need any qualification. You need sincerity. Maybe you can't even read or write your name, but if you have sincerity in Guru Bhakti and an attitude of surrender and submission and desiring to please a Guru, you can have a PhD in Guru Seva. You can be the most expert service of the Guru if you're always thinking of the Guru's pleasure 24 hours a day instead of thinking of ourselves or yourself. So Srila Prabhupada, he taught us how to love Krishna by teaching us how to love Him. As Prabhupada often told his disciples, service is love. And Prabhupada taught that by his own example. Service is love. That's what love means. Love means to serve, and service is love. Service is an expression of our love. The more we love the Guru, the better we serve. If we don't love the Guru very much or at all, then our service is very poor, very infrequent, first of all, and very sloppily done, second of all. But as our love for Guru increases and the quality and quantity of our service increases exponentially, more love, more quantity of service, more love, more quality of service. This is perfection. Guru Bhakti, Guru Seva equals Krishna Bhakti and Krishna Seva. Love of Guru becomes love of Krishna. Guru Prasad becomes Krishna Prasad. The mercy of Guru gives the mercy of Krishna. Prasad means love, service, mercy. So this is an entry about life, Ayur. And this is number 69. Prabhupada was telling in 73 in Los Angeles that there's three things that are actually keeping him alive. So what are those three things that were maintaining Prabhupada's physical health? And these will also help anyone. So first thing he said was my morning walk, my daily morning walk, my daily massage with mustard oil or sandalwood oil on his head, and my Ayurvedic medicine. So Prabhupada in the morning, every morning around sunrise, he would go with some of his followers and walk for about 1 to 2 hours. From 5 to 7, 5:30 to 7:15, and then come back for Sringar Artik, greeting the deities, and Guru Puja, then Bhagavatam class. That was Prabhupada's daily schedule. I remember Los Angeles, I had the fortune of going on 2 morning walks with Prabhupada. One was on Venice Beach, and I think they were both on Venice Beach, or maybe Santa Monica Beach. I can't remember. This is 1976, I believe. And there was quite a few devotees. Of course, big leaders were there, Rameshwar and other sannyasis, I can't remember, but they were there. And Prabhupada was walking on the beach, and he walked so fast, it was very difficult for all of us 24-year-old men to keep up with this Prabhupada, who was 80 at the time, practically more than three times our age, and he walked more than three times our speed. He always walked at a very brisk pace, from 1 to 2 hours, and always at a brisk pace, very fast, quickly, jaldi. And then his morning massage, this morning walk was done between 5 and 7. After Prabhupada had already been up for 4 or 5 hours, he would wake up every day, and let's say rise at 1 o'clock and translate the Bhagavatam until 5. And then bathe and take and chant his Gayatri and take his walk. His morning massage was done every day also around the same time, just before noon, usually 11 o'clock or 10:30 or 10 o'clock. It would last between 1 to 2 hours. And it was an Ayurvedic type massage done with sandalwood oil on his head to keep him cool and mustard oil on the rest of his body. And Prabhupada said at that time, sandalwood oil helps keep a cool head and mustard oil is heating. This type of massage is very good for blood circulation. Prabhupada liked this massage done very vigorously. And evening before resting, he would take a dry massage, mainly on his feet and legs, for up to 1 hour. And then he also took the same Ayurvedic medicine the entire time, from 72 to 75. It was a tonic called Yogendra Ras, which was different ingredients, some gold powder and pearls crushed in small quantities, and into small balls, reddish in color. So Prabhupada, this medicine was also mixed with black cardamom seeds. And that was the anupam to take the medicine with. So Prabhupada was taking this mixture every other morning before his morning walk. And Shruti Kirti would take two small balls and a little of the black sesame and one black cardamom and a dab of raw honey and smash it in a black marble mortar and pestle. And he would make it into a paste, mix it thoroughly. And Prabhupada would take the pestle in his hand and get as much tonic as possible on the pestle and place the pestle in his mouth, licking off every bit. Then he would pick up the small mortar and with his tongue lick every bit that was left. Prabhupada never wasted anything. Never, and his medicine was no exception. So this is another example how Prabhupada didn't waste anything. The medicine is very costly. Each milligram of the medicine probably costs 50 rupees or 100 rupees. These type of medicines are gold powder and multi basma and gold basma, sona basma. Very, very costly. One tablet, maybe 200 rupees, 300 rupees, maybe more. So Prabhupada didn't want to waste it, and he didn't waste anything. He licked up every drop of it. Just like we make cheese, oftentimes devotees are cooking, they buy some milk and boil it and curdle with some lemon juice, and they make cheese. And then they pour it and they strain it, and then there's all the whey, and the whey or the liquid, the green water, the liquid remaining after making cheese, and they throw it out, they throw it down the sink, which is a terrible waste, because it's actually part of the blood of the cow. The cow eats so much grass and grain and other vegetables and turns it into blood, and the blood gets transformed into milk. And then the milk is purchased from the cow, given for human beings. So the green liquid, or the whey, is actually called liquid protein. It's very healthy and very nourishing to the human body. And most people just throw it down the drain. But it should be used. It can be used to mix the chapati dough. It can be used for steaming the sabjis or cooking the dal or any number of places. And people say, oh, I don't like the taste. It's too sour, or this or that. Well, better we become accustomed to the taste, because it's actually very healthy and it's not wasteful. To throw the whey down the sink is not the way to go. This is the way of wasting. Waste not, want not. There's a phrase in English, waste, want not. So everything can be utilized. Then later, after one separates the whey from the cheese, and then he collects the cheese from a pot and puts it in a cheesecloth, or he hangs it in a strainer. But in the pot itself, there's always so many cheese particles sticking all over the pot here and there. And that's also very valuable and useful. That's also the blood of the cow, Dharma Mata, Dharma Bhumi, Gomata. One of the seven mothers of the human beings is the Gomata. So her products should not be wasted. So one should take a spoon and scrape every bit of cheese off the pot, or even take his finger and rub it very hardly on the pot, and collect all the bits of cheese and then and gather them together from the pot and clean the pot very thoroughly and mix all those particles of cheese with the complete ball of cheese that's already been removed. And this way you utilize everything for the offering and for the distribution of prasadam. Don't waste anything. Such a valuable foodstuff as cheese. But we can often see how devotees are so wasteful in this way, especially these vital, most precious food items like cow's milk and cow's cheese and butter. You should never waste a morsel or a portion. So here, if we review it, what Prabhupada said, these are the three things that keep me alive: his brisk 2-hour morning walk, his vigorous 2-hour morning massage, and his vigorous, this I don't know how vigorous it was, but his eating massage for up to one hour. So he's getting 3 hours of massage a day and walking for 2 hours every day. So this is 3 hours of massage, 2 in the morning, 1 at night, and 2 hours morning. That's 5 hours. So Prabhupada was spending 5 hours a day on bodily maintenance. And yet he was doing so much service, right? He wrote 10,000 letters in reply to his disciples. He opened 108 temples. He translated and commented on over 80 books. He trained and initiated 5,000 disciples. And he traveled around the world 14 times with so many preaching engagements. And he gave morning conversations and morning walk conversations and room conversations and daily Bhagavatam classes and daily Gita classes. He did so much. And so much contribution to improve the world and to improve the life of people within the world as everyone's well-wisher. But nevertheless, he was spending every day five hours a day on personal bodily maintenance, maintaining the vehicle that was given by Krishna, his sacred body, which was given by Krishna for the service of the Lord. So it's not out of the question to spend some time on bodily maintenance, a daily morning walk or daily yoga exercises or massage. Of course, Prabhupada was old at this time, 1972, 1975. He was 75, 80-year-old man. But so he was definitely very particular about maintaining his physical health so that he could render the maximum service to the Lord, maximum performance. Prabhupada was maintaining a high-performance engine, high-performance vehicle, and it required a lot of proper maintenance and proper care. So it's quite an amazing point to consider that 5 hours a day he was spending on bodily maintenance. Of course, while he was getting massage, he'd be chanting japa or he'd be preaching during his morning walks. He didn't waste much time. He often did two things at once. While being massaged, he would inquire or speak about Krishna or ask questions or have debates with his disciples. He didn't really waste time. But even if he didn't speak or didn't chant japa, it would be no waste of time because Prabhupada is always thinking of Krishna. Manamana bhavamad bhakto madhyaji man namaskuru. So Prabhupada, he preferred the Ayurvedic way of life. And this is continuing in entry 69 that Prabhupada followed it, what we call an Ayurvedic lifestyle. He would get up before sunrise, take a cold bath, and get morning sun during his walk. These are basic common sense principles in Ayurveda. So sunshine is very good for one early in the morning and a brisk morning walk. These are common sense principles. Cold water bath in the morning is also very healthy. Prabhupada would eat local fruits for breakfast with his milk or yogurt and had his main meal while the sun was highest in the sky. Highest in the sky means between 12 and 1, usually the sun is directly overhead. And all these things we're hearing are also echoed in books in Ayurveda, the science or the laws of life, the science of health. Ayurveda means life or health, and Veda means knowledge. So the ancient precepts and teachings of how to maintain good physical health, Prabhupada was exemplifying them. Yad yada charati shrestas tat tadeve tarojana sayat pramanam kurute lokastana navartate. Whoever a great man does, the common follows. Whatever standards he accepts by exemplary acts, all the world pursues. So Prabhupada was the acharya of spiritual life and the acharya of material life also. He taught the ideal path of self-realization, Krishna Bhakti, Prema Bhakti, Krishna, Radha Krishna Prema Seva, based on chanting the Maha Mantra, Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, and preaching, helping others, and following strict religious principles. They also followed strict health principles, or Ayurvedic principles, of internal cleanliness and external cleanliness, and proper maintenance of the body by eating sattvic, pure vegetarian foodstuffs offered to Krishna, sanctified food, Krishna Prasadam, and a daily exercise program, a massage program. So Prabhupada was really an Ayurvedic man. He followed an Ayurvedic lifestyle. Early to bed, early to rise makes one healthy, wealthy, and wise. So there's no question of Prabhupada's of sleeping after sunrise. He would always get up way before sunrise, at 1 o'clock, even before Brahma Muhurt hour. And then take his cold bath, get his morning sun during his walk, and then he ate local fruits wherever he was. He ate the fresh fruits growing in the area or in the country. So he ate a very light breakfast, just some milk and fruit, maybe a piece of sandesh, some milk sweet from the deities. And his main meal, basically he's eating one meal a day, was at noon. And his regular lunch was rice and dal, chapatis and a few chunks of vegetable preparations. Very simple, simple food. And the evening, about 8 o'clock, about 2 hours before Prabhupada took rest. Prabhupada would take rest at 10 o'clock or 11 every night. So around 8 o'clock he would have very hot milk with honey. And if he had a good appetite, it's interesting, he says honey here. This is in 1973, but in 72 we heard in Australia he was asking for sugar. But at any rate, and this reminisces on page 112 of What is the Difficulty, Shruti Kirti is saying that at night, 2 hours before rest, Prabhupada would have very hot milk with honey. And if he had a good appetite, some prasadam. Only occasionally did Prabhupada eat deep-fried foods like puris and samosas, although he liked them very much. So whenever Prabhupada was sick, or let's say he was very in tune with his body, and as soon as he noticed some sign of imbalance or ill health, he would make an adjustment in his eating and massage. Instead of his normal lunch, he would often take khichdi, which is easy to digest, and is well known for balancing all the three doshas in Ayurveda. Doshas means the energy, the three, let's say, prakrutis, vata, air, the air element. Dosha means the air element, or pitta, the fire element, or kaph, which is the water element, which is earth and water together. So when these get imbalanced, these three doshas, then there can become sickness. Because when they're out of balance, it's the cause of all disease in the body. So Prabhupada often said, which all of us devotees that joined in the early 70s, mid-70s, we heard so much, that there's three causes of disease. Anxiety, uncleanliness, and overeating. So we heard this so many hundreds of times when we joined, and we always used to think if we got sick, oh, I must have been in anxiety, because usually we were victims, as new bhaktas, we were victims of all three. We're always in anxiety about something, and always unclean, not least internally, and overeating too much prasadam. So overeating, what does overeating mean? It means eating more than you can digest. If you can digest 10 chapatis, eat 10 chapatis. But if you can only digest one, then eat one. This is Prabhupada said. So another Ayurvedic principle is to eat alone. So Srila Prabhupada always did this. He had a very sweet way that he would get everyone to leave the room. Very cordial and sweet way. Prabhupada did not use utensils or drink water during his meal. He didn't use any knife or fork or spoon. He always ate with his right hand. And he chewed his food very well. Once Prabhupada was laughing and he said, the best thing for health is to cook for yourself. That way, no matter how hellish it tastes, you will like it because you made it. Of course, Prabhupada is being facetious, because nothing he ever cooked tasted hellish. It was always like pure nectar from the spiritual world, Amrit. But in his own humility, he was saying that even if you cook it, over the last 20 years living in Vrindavan, I had opportunity to learn a little cooking, not much, cook a little khichdi or a little sabji, dal. And I had the experience when I lived in Gopal Mandir for 10 years during Kartik or Chaturmasya, cooking. It actually, many times what I cooked was hellish. But I had no choice. I ate it. I offered it to Giriraj. I don't know if he accepted it, but he tolerated it. And afterwards it was my custom, because generally I made too much to eat for one person. So I put it out on the ledge on the roof. And then the crows would come and the monkeys would come and eat the leftover khichdi or sabji. But oftentimes when I made one of my quote-unquote, as Prabhupada would say, hellish preparations, I would put it out on the ledge, and then the monkeys would run up in great anticipation, and they would pick up a piece. And it's always their habit to smell something before they eat it. They're very particular, although they eat so many things. And I remember this monkey put it up to his mouth, and he made this expression, "Oh!" And then he just put it back down. He didn't even touch a bite of it. Then I thought, oh, it's really hellish. Not even the monkeys want it. And I said, well, I still had some hope with the crows. So after the monkeys ran away, rejecting my offering, my so-called prasadam, and then my remnants or leftovers, then the crows flew in, and they landed there on the edge of the roof, and they hopped over to the prasad, anticipating some good mercy from Giriraj. And then they started to peck at it, and then they went, oh, I don't know what expression they made, but immediately they flew away one by one. Some would peck at it, but then reject it. So it was so bad, or as Prabhupada would say, hellish, the monkeys and crows wouldn't even eat it. But now, after some time, I have a little more experience, so. But it's certainly a fact that if you cook for yourself and offer to your Thakurji, that you eat it. Of course, it's the best thing for health. So this is very interesting. Entry 71. Prabhupada is saying, he said that just by reading this one book, you can become Krishna conscious. So Shruti Kirti went into Prabhupada's room to perform his duties, and he saw Prabhupada reading Bhagavad Gita as it is. And Prabhupada looked at Shruti Kirti and he said, listen, if you just read this one book, Bhagavad Gita as it is, and if you understand it, you'll become Krishna conscious in this very lifetime. So that's a fact. The Bhagavad Gita is perfect. The teachings of Lord Krishna to Arjuna, then the illuminating purports, Bhaktivedanta Swami, ecstatic purports, further elucidating the subject matter about karma, jnana, and bhakti, and how to perform pure devotional service, and how to surrender absolutely and equivocally to the lotus feet of Krishna, and to love Him, to remember Him, and always chant His glories, and depend on Him, and take shelter of Him, and abandon all their attachments and duties. These teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, if one realizes them by reading over and over again, then he will attain perfection, no doubt, and become Krishna conscious, and go back home, back to Godhead, as Prabhupada is explaining. A few months later, Shruti Kirti went in the room and found Prabhupada reading Nectar Devotion. And Prabhupada looked at Shruti and said, this book is so nice. Just by reading this one book, you can become Krishna conscious. So it's interesting that Prabhupada, he was, of course, all these transcendental books, if you read any transcendental book about Krishna, especially purported by a pure devotee, or any of the books of the six Goswamis, or Bhaktivinoda Thakur, or Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, then one will surely become Krishna conscious by such sincere reading endeavor. But another point that's told here is that Prabhupada's teaching by example. As I mentioned earlier, he's the ideal acharya. Achara means behavior. Acharya means one who exhibits or teaches others by his behavior, his proper social etiquette and social dealings and behavior, and his proper example of spiritual pursuits and practices, personal practices in his own life, and how he teaches and helps others and guides others according to the basis of Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu. These are all what makes up perfect behavior, transcendental and material behavior of a sadhu or saintly person. So Prabhupada was the ideal acharya, so he taught by his example. Everything Prabhupada, whatever Prabhupada did, he did everything that he asked of us. He said, I'm writing these books for you. I want my disciples to read these books. Well, Prabhupada himself also read the books. He requested us to read his books, and he also read them too. So he wasn't asking us to do something he didn't do himself. He would say we should preach to the conditioned souls. Well, he also did it himself. We should study the books of the six Goswamis. He did it himself. We should read his books. He read them himself. So this is entry 76. This is also very commonly known in Los Angeles, and being like a very sunshiny state in America, the devotees are very keen to worship the sun and always sit in the sun. I remember we would go through the temple commander's room, Rajaswat, some of his friends, and I was one of the inner circle of the temple commander's friends, and we would go through his room and sit on the roof and in the sunshine in the morning sometimes, remembering that Prabhupada said the morning sun gives you energy. So that's what it was like in April. In April in 73 in Los Angeles, Prabhupada was also there. Whenever it was sunny, Prabhupada would take his morning massage in the garden. He would sit with his back facing the sun, and Shruti would rub mustard oil on his back. At that time, Prabhupada said his immortal teaching that all of his senior disciples remember very well, that the morning sun gives you energy and the afternoon sun takes it away. So knowing this instruction of Prabhupada, we were very keen to always sit in the sun in the morning, sometime between 9 and 12. As Prabhupada did, it was usually around 11 to 12:30. Around 11 to 12, Prabhupada would sit in the sun and take his massage. So this is another practical instruction Prabhupada gave about maintaining good physical health to carry on the service of Krishna. Take advantage of some morning sun on the back, especially the back or face or whatever. This morning sun, the sun is very nourishing for the eyes and for the skin and also for the whole body, because vitamin D is absorbed that way through the skin. So it's recommended to take a little morning sun. So once Prabhupada was not feeling well, this is entry 83, so he had some cold and he asked his servant to make some khichdi and kadhi sauce. He says, you can make the khichdi 2 parts rice, 1 part dal, use a little salt, turmeric, and ghee. That will be light and easy to digest. So usually whenever Prabhupada had a cold, he would ask for khichdi. Because as we mentioned earlier, khichdi balances all the doshas and is easy to digest and gives him good strength when one is sick. So this is a pretty standard thing. Oftentimes, people ask me what I'm eating, and I say, I eat khichdi every day, and they say, are you sick? Because in India, especially among Punjabis and Sindhis, they think the khichdi is something you only eat once a year, or once every 2 years, whenever you're sick. Otherwise, every day you should have rajbhog or chapan bhog, chakachak bhog, lots of deep-fried things, and samosas and kachoris and pakoras and chutney. But many sadhus and saintly persons, they eat very simply, and they eat khichdi every day because it's easy to digest and it maintains the health and it's quick to prepare. So this is some very hard statements of Srila Prabhupada. This is number 112, and it's titled, it's a quote from Prabhupada. It said, 80% of my disciples are not following of the leaders. So Prabhupada had some pain in his right index finger in February of 73. He was taking some Ayurvedic medicine, sandalwood base, and not getting much relief. And he told Shruti that this pain in his finger was specifically caused by fallen disciples not following the rules and regulations. So his mood was very intense and somber at this time. He didn't like his disciples touching his feet because he said that when my disciples touch my feet, I have to suffer. And then Prabhupada said, they may not be trying to get something material by touching my feet or achieve some goal by touching my feet, but still, the spiritual master has to suffer by accepting their sinful reactions. And Prabhupada was saying that this illness I'm experiencing is because 80% of the leaders are not following the rules and regulations. And then Prabhupada said that at the time of initiation, Krishna relieves the new initiate of all karma due to his past sinful acts. However, the spiritual master accepts some of his disciples' karma and suffers the reactions, and this will sometimes cause illness. That's an interesting point that Krishna relieves. Prabhupada is telling, or he told Shruti Kirti on one occasion or others, that Krishna relieves a new initiate, or when one takes initiation, Krishna relieves of all karma due to past sinful acts. the spiritual master accepts some of his disciples' karma and suffers the reactions, and this will cause illness. So the Krishna says it, sarva dharma pratyaja, mam ekam sharanam raja, aham tvam sarva papebhyo, aham tvam sarva papebhyo, moksheshi mimasucha. Krishna is telling that I relieve them, aham tvam sarva papebhyo, all the pap, all the sin, all the sinful reactions, I relieve them. Don't be afraid. Just surrender unto me. Abandon all varieties of religious dharmas. Surrender unto me. So the guru may take a token, but mostly it's taken by Krishna. This is what happens at initiation. But one should be very serious not again to engage in committing sin. So this is entry 133. So he's explaining, Shruti Kirti is explaining how Prabhupada allowed him to leave his service and also return. And he commented that Prabhupada always accepted whatever Krishna provided. And Prabhupada never forced anyone to do anything they could not do. I observed his gracious opulence of renunciation over and over again. So Prabhupada, to repeat, he accepted whatever Krishna provided and never forced anyone to do anything they could not do. But Prabhupada, he would ask disciples to do some services. Of course, nothing was impossible if they actually surrendered and were sincere. But sometimes the disciples were unsuccessful or incapable of fulfilling the order that Prabhupada gave them. And they would admit their frailties or inability to Prabhupada, and he would overlook it and forgive them and engage them in some other more suitable engagement. So Prabhupada was very gracious. So Shruti Kirti is commenting on how Prabhupada, he accepted whatever Krishna provided. He never forced anyone to do anything. Because love is, everything's based on love. Real love is not force, that's fear. Fear is force. And love is voluntary, love is free, love is based on free will. Loving Krishna is based on expressing our free will. There's no free will, without free will there can't be love. And that's why living entities have free will, so they can have the free choice to show their love and express their love. So he's saying that one must cry for the association of Guru and Krishna. It does not come automatically or cheaply. Prabhupada oftentimes said, devotional service is voluntarily and joyfully performed. So these are two characteristics of devotional service. Devotional service means serving in love, serving the Guru in love, serving Krishna and Guru with love. This is devotion. Devotional service means action or movement, activity, serving. And devotion means bhakti, bhav, priti, prem, love. Feeling full activities, activities full of feeling, activities full of mellow, ras. Devotional service is not just service, it's not work or activity or karma, it's seva. Devotional service, prem seva, prasad seva, artik seva, jap seva, smaran seva, astakaliya. Smarana Seva, this is Seva. Jivera Surupaya Krishnara Nityadas, this is our Sarup. Our Sarup is made of Seva. The devotional service has two characteristics. It's voluntary. Voluntary means that we're expressing our free will. Love is an expression of our free will. So love means service. Love means action, activity, expression. Love is something that's expressed. And is also felt. But those feelings are expressed through actions of the mind and senses and words. Thinking, feeling, willing. Kayo mano vakya. Kayo seva, mano seva, vakya seva, manasi seva. Serving with the mind, serving with the words, serving with the body. Body, mind, and words. It's all incorporated in devotional service. The Prabhupada said over and over again that devotional service is voluntary and joyfully performed, because it's a burden of love, it's expression of love. So Prabhupada would say, sometimes disciples would ask Prabhupada, they would say, "Oh, Prabhupada, why doesn't Krishna force me to serve him?" Then Prabhupada would say, he would reply, "If you're forced, there's no question of love. It must be voluntary." So this is the point you should always remember. A guru or a leader, he cannot expect to demand service or expect service. Disciples are voluntarily serving out of love, out of appreciation, out of gratitude, serving guru. They're great. They love the guru for what he's given, and they're appreciative and grateful. And they're expressing their free will. "Yes, I want to serve. I want to please guru. I want to please Krishna. This is my expression of my purest heart's desire. The core of my being, the very core of my existence, now has become revealed to me, become unfolded. So I'm expressing it as devotional service." So like many Indians, I've also experienced in India since I've been here, that words, some of the Hindi and English words are interchangeable. Like in Hindi, they call the toes are called anguli, and the fingers are also called anguli. The fingers of the hand are called anguli, and the toes are called anguli. Padanguli and hadanguli. Toes of the hand and toes of the feet, or whatever. So many times I met Indians and they would point to their feet and they say, "Oh Maharaj, my fingers hurt." Or they would point to the big toe of their foot, and they would say, "Oh, my thumb hurts." And I said, "That's not your thumb, that's your big toe." So Prabhupada, apparently he had this idea also, and he was telling Shruti Kirti in number 137 about that. He said, "Please, please massage my fingers." and he started massaging his fingers, and he said, "No, my other fingers," and he pointed to his feet. So the toes, because in Hindi the toes are also anguli, the same word. So Prabhupada was saying that his toes, the toes of his feet, were actually his fingers. And he asked, so then understanding that idiosyncrasy of language, then Shruti Kirti, he realized what Prabhupada was teaching him with his gentle lessons. And he concluded, Shruti Kirti said, that "Prabhupada, if you said your toes were fingers, they were fingers. Thank you for letting me massage your 20 fingers." So that's just another cute expression. So now in text 138, Prabhupada is talking about preaching. And what is the service of the disciple to the guru? What is one of his services aside from his own bhajan and his own self-improvement and elevation in the devotional scale from Rado Shara Tata Sara Sangha Bhajana Kriya Nartan Nirvati Tata Nishcha Tato Ruchi Dana Sakti Bhavan Prem? The devotee has to develop his internal attachment and faith and surrender and love for Krishna by practicing bhakti bhajan. But there's also some responsibility and service to the spiritual master. So Prabhupada was explaining to one of his disciples who was preaching in Hawaii and in the Philippines, and he was tending to not only preach but collect a lot of followers. They were listening to his lectures and following his teachings, but although he's Prabhupada's disciple, he was not so much connecting people with the guru. He was almost profiling himself as the guru, as a self-effulgent acharya, and collecting followers and students. Although he wasn't initiating, or maybe even was, it's not clear to me. But Prabhupada was spoke in a very authoritative way when he met this person. And Prabhupada, and these students of this disciple of Prabhupada, sannyasi disciple, they were also worshipping this sannyasi. And Prabhupada even was very tolerant. He said, okay, that your students, they may worship you if they like you very much, that's all right. But your business as my disciple is to bring the students to me. You, after all, you are my disciple. The duty of the disciple is to bring the devotees to the spiritual master. This is your business. Your preaching should be like this. If your preaching does not bring them to this point of surrendering to the spiritual master, of bringing them to me, then all your preaching is useless. So this Prabhupada is making a point about a disciple's duty to that he preaches, but he tries to bring the disciples to the lotus feet of the guru. Of course, at that time in ISKCON there were many disciples. There was 5,000 disciples and only one guru, the Samstakacharya, the founder acharya of ISKCON, Srila Prabhupada. So anyone and everyone we preach to in any temple around the world, in any language, Hindi, French, English, German, Japanese, whatever language we preach to, we bring everyone and encourage everyone to connect with Prabhupada, study his books, follow his teachings and rules, and ultimately prepare themselves and qualify themselves to become initiated disciples of our guru, Srila Prabhupada. That was our pride. That was our pride, to make more and more disciples, or increase the family of Prabhupada, and increase the family of Krishna's bhaktas, the Achyuta Gotra, our family, our ISKCON family. We want to make more and more devotees all around the world to help people and to share the bliss and pleasure of being Krishna's humble servant. Of course, nowadays in ISKCON there are many gurus. I don't know, maybe 80 or 100 different gurus in ISKCON. And different gurus have different moods about this. Some are very ambitious personally to collect so many disciples and initiate them. That's their inspiration for serving Prabhupada and expanding the mission. But some gurus, at least myself particularly, when we have students but we're not so much involved with initiating, we rather like giving instructions and teachings and producing books for everyone. So our general mood is to our general instruction to our disciples is preach Guru Tattva. Of course, it's a very difficult subject. These are three most difficult subjects to understand in Krishna consciousness. One is Shiva Tattva, one is Guru Tattva, and Dham Tattva. The truth about the holy Dham, because it's Aprakat Dham and Prakat Dham, it's manifest and unmanifest, it's visible and invisible, it's Voma Vrindavan, it's the spiritual world. It's very difficult, a very, very difficult subject to understand. Krishna never takes a step out of Vrindavan, but yet it seems that he goes to Mathura, then he goes to Dwarka, but at the same time he's always in Vrindavan. So where is he? Why are the gopis crying if he's always here? So Dham Tattva is very difficult to understand, especially Shiva Tattva. God becomes a devotee and worships himself. Balaram becomes Ananta Shesh. Ananta Shesh becomes Sada Shiva. Then Sada Shiva worships Ananta Shesh. So Sada Shiva is Vishnu Tattva, worshipping Vishnu Tattva. And Sada Shiva expands as Lord Shiva. In this world, in Kailash, Kubera's planet, and Lord Shiva worships Ananta Shesh also. So it's Ananta Shesh becomes a devotee, Shiva Tattva, who is neither Vishnu or Jiva, then he worships Vishnu Tattva, Ananta Shesh. So it gets complicated. Guru Tattva, Sakshat Hari, first he's Sakshat Hari, he's not different from God, and then he's a delegated potency of the Lord, Kripa Shakti Murti. That's the second understanding, that he's not actually directly God, he's representative of God. He's not Sakshat Hari, but he's actually, or Acharya Imam Bijaniyam, he's actually a potency of the Lord. He's a Kripa Shakti Murti of the Lord. Then a third understanding is that he is actually in a particular specified servant with his own Stayi Bhav, his own Siddhadeya or Sarup, at which he personally serves Radha and Krishna in the eternal land of Vrindavan. Three different considerations of Guru. So Guru Tattva, Shiva Tattva, and Dham Tattva are very difficult to understand. So as far as our disciples, we want them to preach the truth of Guru. What are the qualifications of a proper Guru? and what are the teachings of Guru, what is the function of Guru, why does one need a Guru, what is the purpose of initiation, why does one need to take Diksha, what are the qualities of a disciple, what is to be gained, what are the benefits and what is to be gained by taking Diksha, and by serving the spiritual master, to preach Guru Tattva, to preach the non-tattva and sambandha gyan to whomever they meet, should preach as much as possible. And then inspire the people, the conditioned souls, to surrender to Krishna, Sharanagati, and Guru Parashraya, to take shelter in some guru, not specifically me, not that they have to bring disciples to me or bring any new people to me, but they should bring them to the lotus feet of Krishna and any representative they become inspired by. Because they may be in Bombay, it's easier for them to take initiation from local guru there, or in Delhi, or they may be overseas, or anywhere. All the godbrothers are very qualified, and many gurus or most gurus are much more qualified than we are. So we're not personally requiring disciples, saying, yes, it's your duty to bring new people to me. We're simply saying, yes, you should preach Krishna consciousness and inspire people, bring people to inspire people so they understand the need to become initiated and pray to the Lord in their heart and pray to Nityananda in their heart to direct them to their eternal mentor. So this is another entry. This is number 141. It says, Vaishnavas like to laugh. This is 1975 in Mexico City. Of course, sometimes people, they say, oh, you devotees are so pessimistic and so serious. Don't you ever laugh? But devotees laugh a lot. Simply, they're always laughing, actually. Kevala Ananda Kanda. It says, Kevala Ananda Kanda, this process is simply blissful. So bliss means laughing, it's happiness. Prasanna manaso, the mind becomes blissful. So this was in February when Prabhupada was in Mexico City. He would take his daily massage sitting outside in the warm sunshine. And his back was being massaged. And very vigorously, Prabhupada was smiling broadly. And one godbrother came to and met Shruti Kirti. And as soon as they saw each other, they started laughing. And then he was massaging, the one godbrother was sitting there, was an old friend of his. And he was waiting for him to ask Prabhupada a question. And all of a sudden they both started laughing uncontrollably. And Shruti was laughing so hard that he couldn't do his service anymore, and he stopped massaging Prabhupada's back. Prabhupada was not angry. He was in a very calm voice. He said, "What's so funny?" So then Shruti Kirti looked at his godbrother, Paramahamsa, hoping that his godbrother would have some insight into why they both automatically started laughing. But he just sat there quietly. So finally, Shruti said, "I don't know, Prabhupada. When I see Paramahamsa, sometimes it just makes me laugh." So then Prabhupada smiled and he said, "That's okay. Laughing is a Vaishnava activity." So this is a fact. Prabhupada is certifying it, that laughing is a Vaishnava activity. So you could say the converse of that is material life, or the non-Vaishnavas, the Pashandis and the atheists, crying is a Pashandis activity, because the atheists are always crying, they're always sad about one thing or another in their lives, because there's not too much happiness in their lives. But generally they're crying or complaining about something. So true Vaishnavas or true devotees, they're not so much crying about material setbacks. They're crying for Krishna and crying for the prema seva of Krishna and crying with great longing and yearning to have Krishna's darshan, Krishna's eternal service. But they're not crying due to material setbacks or material attachments. And they're always laughing and remembering Krishna's pastimes. So this is describing his entry 146 in Atlanta, Georgia, 1975. Although not very often, but sometimes Prabhupada couldn't contain his ecstatic feelings. And he would reveal them even in front of his disciples. But generally, the advanced devotees If they're experiencing ecstatic symptoms, they try to keep them very private, within the privacy of their own room. They may cry, or they may weep, or their voice may choke up, or they may have so many different symptoms of ecstatic bliss in remembrance of Krishna, or due to their Krishna consciousness. So Prabhupada was explaining to the devotees why Srinivasa Vyasa-san in Atlanta, Georgia, they have Gornitai deities there. He says, Prabhupada says, I've been to Mexico and Caracas and Miami, but I see your temple is the best. And all the devotees said, Jai Hari Bol. And Prabhupada went on to say, this is on a tape people can hear also, 1975, February 28th. So Prabhupada said, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is very kind. Parama Kruna Pahundu Ijana. Two lords, Nittai Gora Chandra, Nityananda Prabhu and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. They are very kind. You see? And Prabhupada pointed to the altar. They have appeared here just to reclaim the fallen souls of this age. So they are more kind than Krishna. Krishna is also very kind. He comes to deliver. But Krishna demands, first of all, surrender. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he does not demand surrender. He is so kind. Then Prabhupada's voice starts choking, which you can hear on the tape. So take shelter of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and be happy. Thank you very much. And Prabhupada broke down, started weeping. So Shruti Kirti is commenting that by seeing their lordships Gauranitai, Prabhupada melted in joy. Inundated by the flood of love of Godhead, tears flowed from Prabhupada's eyes. He was overjoyed to see the deities being so taken care of so well. So what good fortune it was for all the disciples to, and incredibly moving it was to witness Prabhupada's encounters with the lordships. Of course, Prabhupada rarely revealed his ecstatic symptoms, but once on a previous occasion in Mayapur, he also apologized after he went into a trance. At that time, Prabhupada was stunned. Everyone became stunned to see Prabhupada in this mood, and they were astonished. They remained motionless, mesmerized by Prabhupada's transcendental mellows. So Prabhupada, he left external consciousness. And then everyone was waiting for Prabhupada to return. And then as soon as he rejoined, he nodded for a kirtan to begin. So usually Prabhupada had tremendous ability to refrain from displaying such symptoms on a regular basis. He would contain these ecstasies within himself, and sometimes they were too great and he would become overwhelmed by the love of the Lord that was swelling in his heart. Of course, that's also Krishna's arrangement, so that we could see the intensity of Prabhupada's attachment to Radha and Krishna and Gauranitai. So this is something about Maya that Maya is very strong, as we all know. And the more service we try to perform, the more we are tested by Maya. But everyone understands that by following Prabhupada's instructions or the Guru's instructions very carefully, one is protected by the Guru. Prabhupada said many times, he probably would often tell his disciples, by chanting 16 rounds daily and following the regulative principles, Maya cannot touch you. Well, this is entry 153. About prasadam. Prabhupada was always concerned that the prasadam being served in the temples was very, very clean and properly cooked and very tasty and nourishing. So in this entry, Shruti Kirti is commenting how many times Prabhupada spoke about the importance of serving nice prasadam to the devotees. So one of the first lessons Prabhupada taught me was that every visitor must take prasadam before leaving, even if it was only one piece of fruit. So this was Prabhupada's Vedic standard of etiquette. Prasadam means mercy, dadati pratigrihnati. And Rupa Goswami says that this is how devotees express love, by receiving prasad and giving prasad. So whether it's conditioned souls or fellow devotees or senior devotees, whenever we have the opportunity to meet anyone, conditioned souls or devotees, if they come to our house or apartment or kutir or wherever we go, we should carry prasadam with us, especially if someone comes into the confines of our own domicile. We should always have some dry fruit, which is the standard Indian etiquette, to have some tiffin with dried fruit. But have some dried fruit or some aam pak, these little aam candies, or better yet, some fresh kheer prasadam, sweet rice or samosas or some nice Thakurji prasadam. And definitely if anyone comes to visit us, as a routine, as a habit, we should always give them some prasadam. This not only purifies the relationship of one to another, but it spreads Krishna consciousness, because spreading Krishna consciousness means extending love, extending our realization and love for Krishna to others, extending our love to Krishna to others by speaking about Krishna, extending our love and realization of Krishna by chanting about Krishna, singing about Krishna, chanting japa for Krishna, and distributing prasadam, and of course also books, distributing small books of Srila Prabhupada wherever we go or to anyone comes to our house. And this way we'll be fulfilling Prabhupada's wish and desire that all guests would always get prasad, guests and or friends, god brothers, friends and disciples or whatever. So this again is entry 154 in Mayapur, 1975, April 6th. Prabhupada said, just chant Hare Krishna. So again is another ecstatic symptom Prabhupada was displaying. So when Prabhupada would display ecstatic symptoms, it was considered to be the rarest of treasures, because it wasn't done very often. These were exceptional events, but they often took place when Prabhupada was sitting on his Vyasasan in the temple room during the lecture. The most widely known example took place during the Mayapur festival. This is in 1975, Mayapur, India, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's Janamstan. There were hundreds of devotees in the temple room. And while Prabhupada was speaking, he suddenly stopped and became silent, and his eyes closed right in the middle of his talk. You could hear, you could not, a pin drop could not be heard. Even devotees bared not to breathe very loudly. This went on for some time. Hundreds of devotees were transfixed, looking at Prabhupada, observing Prabhupada's internal state, each being transported by his personal rapture. The minds of the disciples were overwhelmed with anticipation. Srila Prabhupada had carried us all to another realm. Suddenly one sannyasi seated near Prabhupada's Vyasasan began to loudly chant, Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale. I felt jolted from a heavenly realm, said Shruti Kirti. Gradually the reluctant devotees began to join in the kirtan. Soon Prabhupada regained his external consciousness and joined his disciples in the kirtan. After the kirtan, there was some disagreement amongst the god brothers. Someone criticized the sannyasi, saying, how could you do that? Prabhupada was in ecstasy. You could see no one else was chanting. You should have stopped. Then he replied, oh, I thought I would chant. It seemed like the right thing to do. No one could arrive at a conclusion, so they took the issue to Prabhupada in the afternoon. And Brahmananda asked, Prabhupada, do you remember at the lecture when you stopped speaking and went into ecstasy? He was quite blunt. Before he could continue, Brahmananda, Srila Prabhupada responded in the sweetest voice, sounding a little embarrassed. Prabhupada said, I do not do that very often. No, Prabhupada, but when it does happen, what should we do? Should we just sit there, Srila Prabhupada, or should we chant japa? Prabhupada said, yes, you chant. You chant Hare Krishna. Just chant Hare Krishna. Why are you making such a big thing? What is to be done? Just chant Hare Krishna. That is all right. The Shruti Kirti says that when he heard Prabhupada say, in relation to displaying ecstasies, Prabhupada said, I do not do that very often. It was the most innocent voice that he had ever heard. The gentle grace and humility that Prabhupada displayed was amazing. Prabhupada was apologizing for exhibiting the ecstatic symptoms of a pure devotee. It appeared that Prabhupada felt awkward exposing us to his personal moments with Krishna. Of course, this was one of the most wonderful things about Prabhupada, that he always made all his disciples feel that if we just followed the process of Krishna consciousness, then we could all advance to the perfectional stage without difficulty. Right? What is the difficulty? It seemed that Prabhupada never wanted to discourage any of us by showing how special he was, thus allowing us to consider that Krishna consciousness was actually too difficult for neophytes. Prabhupada always gave us hope. He always encouraged us. And he made us feel that Krishna consciousness was for all of us. We could all become perfect. We could all become lovers of Krishna, even in this lifetime. It's simple, sublime, and perfect. And Prabhupada always spoke of himself in the plural. He always said, "We are Krishna's servant." Prabhupada was including all of his disciples also. So in that same way, on that special day in Mayapur in 75, he transported all of his disciples to the other realm, the spiritual realm. So Prabhupada is always continuing to take all of his disciples back home, back to Godhead. So Shruti Kirti concludes this entry 154 by saying, "Srila Prabhupada, thank you for a peek into your private moments. I would have loved the opportunity to sit at your feet in that temple room for hours. I can only imagine where you were. I take great pride in knowing that you are the topmost personality within the three worlds. Still, you spoke humbly about revealing a glimpse of your internal ecstasy. I beg for the chance to hear your sweet voice again and again." That's a very beautiful conclusion to that entry about Prabhupada's ecstatic symptoms seen in Mayapur. So this is something, this is entry 157. Prabhupada's talking about sleep. And generally when Prabhupada would talk about sleep, he would say that it's a waste of time, or he said sleeping is a dead condition, sleeping is death. Whereas we look forward to sleeping with great relish, and many of us, we find great happiness in sleeping long, long hours, like bears, sleeping our lives away, one third, one half of our life wasted in sleeping, nothing productive, no progress, no advancement, just sleeping like a log, dead to the world, dead to Krishna, dead to Seva. Right, all, for all practical matters, completely dead. But Prabhupada, he would utilize every minute in Krishna's service. On an average, Prabhupada was only sleeping 3 to 4 hours a day. Oftentimes he would take rest at 11 o'clock at night and get up at 1 to translate. And this is the eyewitness account of Shruti Kirti, who traveled with Prabhupada for 2.5 years as his personal servant. He saw, it's not some imagination, it's not some advertising. The Prabhupada actually, and other times that was 3 hours, 11 to 1, and sometimes he took rest at 10 to 1, so that's 4 hours. Of course, we can't imitate. There's Anusaran and Anukaran, imitating the Guru and following in his footsteps. So following his footsteps means reducing his sleep as much as possible according to our condition and position and our realization and our attachment to Krishna. We can't be artificial. We can't imitate. "Oh, Prabhupada slept 3 hours a day, so now tomorrow I'm going to start. I'll take rest at 11, get up at 1. So we can do it for 2 days, and then we'll be crashed out for 1 week, sick and immobilized. So better we try to reduce. If we can sleep 6 hours a day and no more snaps or resting in between, that's very good. If we can reduce to 5, that's even better. But the idea is the following footsteps means to sleep as less as possible and not relish it, not look forward to it, try to minimize it and reduce it. This means following the footsteps. Anusaran. Anusharan. So sometimes when Shruti was traveling with Prabhupada, Prabhupada would look at his servant when Prabhupada was about to take rest and say, "Oh, now I'm going to waste my time." So Prabhupada considered that sleeping was a waste of time, not an investment. It was not a good investment, not something relishable, or something to look forward to, or something to try to find 5 minutes here, or 10 minutes here, or a half hour here, to dive into the nectar of ignorance, the nectar of ignorant consciousness. We want to dive into the nectar of Krishna consciousness, not dive into the nectar of tamagun, tamagun amritam, tamagun amritam, the nectar of ignorance. So we want to dive into Krishna conscious, Krishna bhavanamritam, Krishna bhavanamrita sangam, dive into the nectarine association of loving devotees of Krishna. So now in text and number entry 158, Prabhupada is explaining the different types of disciples, or different disciple means servant, love means service. So Prabhupada is describing what is a first, this is first class servant. The Prabhupada said the first class servant, he does his service without being asked. This is something else, some other idea that all the disciples heard early in the 70s, because we were all aspiring to try to become first class servants of Prabhupada. So then we understood the first class means anticipating the needs and desires of the master and acting accordingly even without being asked. So of course one has to be tanmaya or tanatmika with the guru's mind and heart to understand what he wants before he asks it, and to anticipate his upcoming needs and wants and fulfill them. So this is a matter of love, like the gopis were heart to heart with Radharani, or the mandris are heart to heart with Lalita and Rupa and Rati and Radharani. So they know what they want by an eye signal, or even before they make a signal, so they make all the proper arrangements for their pleasure and satisfaction and help the Leela go on progressively, smoothly, sweetly and charmingly. So first class servant, he does his service without being asked. The second class servant, you ask him to do something and he does it. And the third class servant, you ask him and he does it begrudgingly, or he doesn't do it at all. So of course this means the third class means third class love, or less at least love. No real feelings, no real attachments, no real absorption, no real sincere concern to please the beloved. Simply, oh, okay, I have to do it, all right, somehow I do it, begrudgingly. So Prabhupada is giving a nice definition here of the different categories of servants. This is entry 161 in New Delhi, 1975. This is pre-ISKCON, 1961. Prabhupada was reminiscing or telling Shruti Kirti about the austerities that he performed in the cause of preaching. This is 1961. Prabhupada was living in Radhadamodar, and he had his office in Delhi in Chippewada, in Old Delhi, and he would go there regularly for printing books or newspapers or small books. And Prabhupada said, while I was living in Vrindavan, sometimes I would go to Delhi for a few days to make arrangements with my publisher. I would stay in one room during those periods. During the winter in Delhi, it was so cold, I would have to crack a thin layer of ice with my lota in my bucket of water, bath water. Then I would take bath of that water. So this is cold water. Prabhupada said it, Ayurvedic says it. Taking a bath in cold water in the morning, the first bath, is very healthy. So you can imagine, Prabhupada was taking a bath. In 1961, he was 65 years old and he was bathing in ice water in Delhi. There's no question about Prabhupada performing austerities. This is entry 163. So once in 1975, Prabhupada was in Perth, Australia. And this is some discussion about the Srimad Bhagavatam and the different facts there. Like fifth canto describes the construction of the universe and the distance between planets. There's so many different astrological facts and discussion about planets and stars. And sometimes maybe these details don't match the modern scientists' discoveries and investigations about the structure of the universe or the cosmology. So scientific disciples of Prabhupada would become disturbed and agitated, and to the extent that sometimes they would bloop or give up their faith in Krishna, and especially Prabhupada and Bhagavatam, and become karmis again over some minute detail of the Bhagavatam's description of the material universe. But actually the intention of Bhagavatam, Bhagavatam is a rasa shastra. Srimad Bhagavatam is the Bhagavat Sarup, the Prem Sarup of Vrindavan Sri Krishna and Srimati Radharani. And the intention of Bhagavatam is to bring people to the point of pure bhakti, to Braja Bhakti, to appreciate the pure love of the gopis of Vrindavan and try to emulate them and follow them in parampara by doing bhajan, Raghunuga bhajan, and specifically Manjari Sarup bhajan at the higher end of development, where one follows a particular resonant of Vrindavan, like Rupa Goswami, Rupa Manjari, Raghunath Das Goswami, Rati Manjari, and attain the perfection of life, which is the eternal loving service of Radha Govinda and the pleasure groves of Sri Vrindavan Dham. And who really cares about 24 hellish planets or this thing or that thing? This is the real intention of Bhagavatam. The perfection of Bhagavatam is describing the different levels of devotion, different levels of bhakti, and finally culminating in the Radha Bhakti, Gopi Bhakti of the Brijvasis of Vrindavan. There's different kings, there's different personalities, demons and devotees, Dhruva Maharaj, Prahlad Maharaj, and different forms of the Lord, the Das Avatar, the 24 incarnations of Vishnu, and teachings of Rishabhadev, and all these different avatars and forms of the Lord, and all these different devotees, and finally, Karma Mishra Bhakti, Jnana Mishra Bhakti, Shuddha Bhakti, Jnana Mishra Bhakti, Shanta Bhakti, Dasya Bhakti, and finally, Madhurya Prema Bhakti. So this is really Bhagavatam. It's all about bhakti. Bhagavat, devotees, and Bhagavat the Lord. One time, Paramahamsa Swami, he asked Prabhupada, how is it that the sun is always shining somewhere on the earth planet if actually the sun is going behind Sumeru Mountain? Wouldn't it be dark on the entire planet? Prabhupada was silent for a moment and then replied, we're not so interested in these details. The Srimad Bhagavatam is just a very short summary to give some idea of the creation of the Lord, but it is not scientific. We are not interested in science. We are interested in developing love of God. So that was Prabhupada's response to this scientific, so-called scientific detail, the fifth canto of Bhagavatam, about the structure of the universe and the movements of the planets. So although Prabhupada would often have debates with his students who would take the role of or pose themselves as a materialistic scientist, and it would be very exciting. And Prabhupada didn't mind that, often did it in his morning walks to debate with the material scientist. But Prabhupada went on to say that if the Bhagavatam were to be scientific, it would take volumes and volumes to explore how the creation is done. But this was not Sukadev's purpose in speaking the Srimad Bhagavatam. He did not want to explain very minutely or scientifically the creation. He just wants to give us some basic understanding that Krishna has created everything. In other words, behind all this fantastic arrangement and complete such complex arrangement of millions of galaxies and millions and billions of stars and planets all moving so precisely and exactly in their orbits, that there must be some fantastic intelligence behind it, organizing and maintaining and controlling it. And that intelligence is part of the personality known as Krishna. The Prabhupada said that Krishna, that Shukadev wrote the Bhagavatam. Why did he write the Bhagavatam? As a science book? No. As a book about Bhagavat, Bhagavat Sri Krishna. Shukadev just wants us to understand Krishna has created everything. Develop love of Krishna. Prabhupada goes on. That is all. If you can't understand it, you accept the Bhagavatam because it is there in the scriptures. We don't bother our minds trying to understand how it could be like this. It seems very difficult. We are not concerned. We just want to develop love of God. Actually, I am not giving any more information. Simply what is there. I am not an astronomer, so I may not understand all the details. Those details are given in another part of the Vedas. Shukadeva Goswami is giving some basic summary ideas of the universal operation. That was Prabhupada's reply. So this is the point, that the Bhagavatam may say this or that. But Prabhupada said the main thing Bhagavatam is teaching us is how to love Krishna. And that's the purpose of Krishna consciousness, and that's why we've come to ISKCON, and why we're serving Krishna. Prema Pumarta Mahan, that the ultimate goal, or the Mahapurusharta, the Panchama Purusharta, the fifth goal of life, beyond Dharma, beyond Kam, beyond art and Kam and Moksha, or Moksha, Vaikuntha Moksha, Brahmasuja Moksha, beyond all of that, beyond all of those limited attainments, is the perfectional attainment of pure loving service of Krishna. Prem Purusharta. And this is why we came to Krishna consciousness. This is what we're looking for, and this is what we desire, and this is our prayojan. This is our necessity and our goal. So anything that helps us to go there, we accept, and anything that slows down our progress, we reject. So we're not so much concerned about the distance between planets or the orbits of the sun or the moon. We're concerned about loving Krishna. Sharanagati, surrender, humility, and seva. These are our primary concerns. We want to be scientists of devotion, scientists of love, and scientists of surrender. Not cosmologists, and not astronomers, but pure bhaktis, shuddha bhaktis, premi bhaktis of Radha and Krishna. This is our goal, and this is our perfection. So this is entry 172 in Shruti Kirti's book. What is the difficulty? There's some discussion about taking birth in India in 1975 in Honolulu, Hawaii, on June 10th. So the disciples were concerned whether or not they would be able to attain perfection without having taken birth in India, because most of Prabhupada's disciples, if not all, were born in Western countries, Mlechadesh, Papa Bhumi, etc. So Shruti Kirti asked Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, the other day Govinda Dasi asked you, in general, would we have to take birth in India before going back home? And at that time you said yes. So we were wondering how that's possible, that we have to take birth in India, because we haven't seen so many strict Vaishnavas in India. And Prabhupada replied, the land of India is there, just like this land. Vaishnavas are there. This land, this western land, Paschim Desh, is not meant for spiritual culture. But still, there are Vaishnavas here. Similarly, in India, there are many Vaishnavas there. The masses of people in India are all Vaishnava. So then one of Prabhupada's disciples, seeking clarification, he asked, well, Prabhupada, by joining ISKCON, we come to the platform where we can take birth in India in a nice Brahmin family. Is that right? And in other words, in our next life. And Prabhupada replied, no. You can also go directly back home, also, if you want to finish your business. Then Prabhupada quoted from Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada said, Shuchinam Shimatam Gehe. This consideration is there, that one who fails in the execution of his bhajan. But if you are successful, then you go directly where Krishna is there. Krishna is there in some universe. So those who are completely liberated, they go to that universe. Just like when Krishna comes here. In each and every universe there is Vrindavan. So in that Vrindavan one will take birth and then go to the original Vrindavan. So the disciple continued, well, Prabhupada, those who are not able to maintain their Krishna consciousness or the Krishna conscious principle, will they have to go to India in the next lifetime? And Prabhupada said, yes. Srimatam Suchinam Gehi. Srimatam, you can get here. Srimatam means rich family. Here you can get many rich families, Ford family. But Srimatam and Suchinam. So if you're creating so many Brahmanas, so if this cult is permanent, then there will be many Brahmin families here in the West also. So you may take Suchinam, as the sixth canto Bhagavatam says, if you fail, you take birth. If you practice some spiritual activities for a long time, you take birth in Suchinam. Brahmin family, or even better than Brahmin, is Vaishnava family. And if you fail after a short time, you take birth in a rich family. The Prabhupada's saying, not necessarily you have to take birth in India, because now there's so many Brahmins being made and created and perpetuated in Western countries. You may take birth in a Brahmin family even in America. In other words, one of Prabhupada's disciples. So by this, Prabhupada satisfied the restless minds of his disciples, worried that they might have to take a birth in India, which was a fate worse than death if you've already been born in America. But I guess in those days, in 75, the devotees were not so keen on living in India. But nowadays it's a little different. Devotees like to live in India. Rather, they give up their American land to live permanently in India. Now this is a small piece at the end where Shruti Kirti is talking about the time factor and separation from Prabhupada. So he says, page 332, sometimes during a lecture on Bhagavatam, Srila Prabhupada, you would stop and look at your watch. Looking at us youngsters, you would tell us that no matter how much money you have, it is impossible to buy back that moment in time. I was so young and foolish, I never understood what you meant. I always thought, we are eternal. What difference does it make? But now, millions of moments are going by, and I am without you, Srila Prabhupada. How many more moments must go by until I see your lotus feet again? It is unbearable in this world without you. So this is his lamentation and separation from his beloved Gurudev, Srila Prabhupada. So this, we're going to conclude this discussion about some high points of what is the difficulty that most impressed me, and I'm sharing with everyone on this Vyasa Puja celebration of Srila Prabhupada in 2007. And this is a rather long one. This is in the epilogue. That this is one of the Shruti Kirti is considering this as one of his favorite letters, which was written by Srila Prabhupada. And his disciple had asked him many questions, so Prabhupada responded to each one of the questions. And more than that, in this response, or in this letter which Prabhupada wrote to his disciple, it wasn't Shruti Kirti, it was another godbrother. But in this letter, Prabhupada is showing his profound loyalty and compassion for his disciple. So this is this Guru-Shishya Sambandha. It's called Guru-Shishya Prem Sambandha. The disciple has what they call Guru-Bhakti, love for his Guru. But the Guru also has Shishya-Bhakti, or Chela-Bhakti. He has love for his disciple. He cares for his disciple. He wants to nourish his disciple. He wants to protect his disciple. He wants to educate his disciple. He wants to elevate his disciple. And he wants to illuminate and enlighten his disciple. And he wants to liberate his disciple by showing his love, giving his love, and giving his teachings. So the Guru also loves the disciple. So therefore it's called Guru-Shishya Prem Sambandha. It's a sambandha, it's a bondage. A bondage of love, it's a relationship of love. And love means service. Guru is serving disciple, and disciple is serving Guru. And together they're cooperating to serve Radha Govinda. Here in this plane of seva, and also in the plane of eternality, the plane of dedication, Brajadam, Brajagokul. So we'll read this letter of Prabhupada. It's a long letter, but we can try to pay attention. Because this is one of the favorite letters, and it's showing Prabhupada's love for his disciple. And the disciple is Tushta Krishna. My dear Tushta Krishna, This is Prabhupada's reply to his letter to his guru. Please accept my blessings. I am in due receipt of your letters dated November 18th, 22nd, and December 3rd, 1972. And I have heard that you are having some difficulties. So I have sent Siddha Sarup there to help you. That's another god brother, a leader there. Now, try to keep a cool head under all circumstances and always remember that Krishna will protect you in any case. You haven't to worry anything. I think that without you, the New Zealand affair will not go on. But now you are leaving there to live in some farm in Australia. Of course, our serving Krishna is a voluntary affair. So what can I say? If you think that that is the best choice, I must agree. Otherwise, you might go away altogether. Which means give up Krishna consciousness. Anyway, we shall discuss in detail if I come there in the future. Regarding the questions in your letter, you have asked me if the spiritual master is ultimately Krishna. So the answer must be that if you think that way, then everyone is Krishna. So why should we think like this? Shaktyavesh avatar means a living entity, but he is specifically empowered, not that he is Krishna, but on account of his exalted position, he is honored as much as Krishna, not that he is Krishna. This is Mayavadi. The guru acts in the position of Krishna, but he is not Krishna. The guru is very dear to Krishna. Yasya prasadan bhagavat prasadan. The guru is acting in the position of Krishna because he is Krishna Preshta or Mukunda Preshta, the most confidential servant of Krishna. Your next question. After leaving the material realm, does a devotee remain forever with his spiritual master? The answer is yes. But I think you have got the mistaken idea in this connection. You speak of a pure devotee, that he is Shaktivesh Avatar, that we should obey him only. These things are the wrong idea. If anyone thinks like that, that a pure devotee should be obeyed and no one else, that means he is nonsense. We advise everyone to address one another as Prabhu. Prabhu means master. So how the master should be disobeyed? Others, they are also pure devotees. All of my disciples are pure devotees. Anyone sincerely serving the spiritual master is a pure devotee. It may be Siddha Sarup or others. This is the name of God brother. This must be very clearly stated. It is not only that your Siddha Sarup is a pure devotee and not others. Do not try to make a faction. This disciple, Siddha Sarup Das. He is a good soul, Prabhupada's disciple, but others should not be misled. Anyone who is surrendered to the spiritual master is a pure devotee. Amongst ourselves, we should respect others as Prabhu, master. As soon as we distinguish, here is a pure devotee, here is a non-pure devotee, that means I am nonsense. Because actually, at that time, this Siddha Sarup was considered a very advanced devotee in that area of the world, and many people were worshipping him on the level of guru and considering that he was way above and beyond all the other god brothers. And Prabhupada didn't appreciate that, so he's trying to rectify this mentality in Tushta Krishna, one of his disciples. Why you only want to be in the spiritual sky with Siddha Sarup Das? Why not all the God brothers? If Siddha Sarup Das can go to the spiritual world, why not everyone? Siddha Sarup will go, you will go, Shyam Sundar Das will go, all others will also go. We will have another ISKCON there. Of course, Mr. Nair must stay. And this Mr. Nair was the owner of the Juhu Beach property, and he sold it to Prabhupada, and then he sold it to two or three other people, and then he tried to renege on his agreement to Prabhupada, with Prabhupada. And he sent so many gundas to break down the temple and create a lot of problems in Prabhupada's Bombay scheme. And ultimately he died one night, and then Prabhupada closed the deal and built the temple of Rasa Bihari. Prabhupada goes on in his letter, "And if somebody does not go, then I shall have to come back to take him there. One should remember this, and every one of my disciples should act in such a way that they may go with me and may not have to come back to take another birth. As for your next question, can only a few pure devotees deliver others? Anyone, if he is a pure devotee, he can deliver others. He can become spiritual master. But unless he is on the platform, he should not attempt it. Then both the guru and disciple go to hell, like blind men leading the blind. Next you ask if I am present in my picture and form. Yes, in form as well as in teachings. To carry out the teachings of guru is more important than to worship the form. But none of them should be neglected. Form is called vapu, and teachings is called vani. Both should be worshipped. Vani is more important than vapu. Your next question is, should we love Krishna or love the spiritual master? You cannot go to Krishna directly loving him. It is common sense that if Krishna is the object of your love, his pet dog is also the object of your love. Friends meet friends, and if the friend is with his dog, the gentleman pats his dog first, is it not? So the man becomes automatically pleased, his dog being petted. I've seen it in your country. The conclusion is this: without pleasing the spiritual master, he cannot please Krishna. If anyone tries to please Krishna directly, he's fool number one. Hoping this meets you and your good wife, Krishna Tulsi Dasi, in good health and devotional mood, your ever well wisher, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami." So in this letter to Tushita Krishna, Prabhupada is showing his profound loyalty and compassion for his disciple. And the final entry here is a closing or a final prayer in the epilogue by the author of What is the Difficulty, Shruti Kirti. So we would like to repeat this and have the same feelings manifest in our mind and heart towards our Gurudev, Srila Prabhupada. My dear Srila Prabhupada, in my final prayer, I cannot ask you for anything. You have already given me everything and answered all my questions. I can only offer my heart and soul to you in service eternally. As you told me years ago, service is love. You do your service and everything will be all right. What is the difficulty? All glories to Srila Prabhupada.